Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk gardening with Melinda Myers of Milwaukee, the host of the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener, and an award winner. She's received the 2007 Perennial Plant Association's Garden Media Award earlier this month in Columbus, Ohio, and it's a pleasure to have here at the microphone. Hi, Mel. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Jim. Always great to talk gardening.
I'm curious, though, because I know that you were scheduled to be part of Wisconsin Arbor Fest at Warner Park in Madison tomorrow morning. And what's the situation with Arborfest?
Well, we're gone, and unless we hear otherwise this morning. So, Corey, if you're listening, call in. But it's a wonderful event. It's a tree climbing competition for arborists throughout Wisconsin. The winner will go then and compete at the International Society of Arboriculture next year, representing our chapter. Mm-hmm. And then I'll be on hand at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning at Warner Park here in Madison to talk trees and talking about how we can beautify the area around our trees without killing them. I call it tree death by good intention, meaning when I worked for the city of Milwaukee Forestry, a bad day would be driving down the street, seeing a pile of railroad ties, a wheelbarrow of soil, and a flat of flowers, because I knew what they were going to do, kill their trees with good intentions. You know, so things like if you want to mulch around the base of your tree, the best thing you can do, perennial ground covers in the existing soil. Do not add soil. I don't want to give my whole talk away. But also all those things you can do to help have a beautiful landscape, but also take care of your trees. And of course, I'll be answering questions and people who've come to visit me. And I want to thank all of those listeners that came by to State Fair to say hello with their baggies, I must add.
Uh-huh.
And I'll be doing the same thing. I'll be around answering questions. So as far as we know, we're on. So hope, keep your fingers crossed for beautiful weather. The Wisconsin Arborist Association on their website will have a few more details, or then check out my website, also melindamyers.com. But we're hoping for sunny weather tomorrow, and unless we hear otherwise, we're going for rain or shine. So
okay, well, certainly rain has been on
yes,
on everyone's mind. The walking on the ground is so soggy right now. Is this not a good time to be working in the garden until it dries out a bit?
Great point. I think we are all waiting. The weeds are getting bigger. The grass is finally growing. Mm-hmm. And so trying to find a time to get out there and cut. But you're right. We don't want to drive equipment or walk on the soil any more than we have to. Those of us struggling with heavy clay, the more we walk, the more equipment, the mowers, any kind of tiller, anything, the more we compact the soil. And we create problems not only short-term but long-term, things we're going to be dealing with. And, you know, we can't take the water out of the soil, but those that are suffering with floods and maybe taking a break from bailing out the basement or the garage, as frustrating as it is, you're going to just have to wait for the water to recede. But one thing we found during some floods, I think it was in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, we had quite a bit of flooding along the Mississippi River. One of the things we found, and anybody that's got flooding conditions will notice, there's a lot of soil on the leaves of your plants. So one of the things we'll have to do once the waters recede and things start settling into a little drier conditions, we may need to hose off some of those leaves, because the soil blocks the sunlight, prevents, you know, photosynthesis from occurring, and we get leaf drop. So the trees are already stressed below ground, and we're adding to the above ground. And then those with containers, I was out of town for a few days, and I have one self-watering pot, and I typically don't use them unless they have a weep hole, something for water logging. And mm-hmm. I happened to get home and I looked and there was 2 inches of water on top of this container. So I dumped it and then I had to hold the whole thing upside down to get the water from the bottom of the pot. It was soaked clear through. So, you know, if you have any self-watering pots that don't have weep holes, you might have to do a little helpful draining or siphoning out the reservoir, because things are a little waterlogged everywhere.
We're talking with Mel Myers, and if you'd like to join the conversation, there's one line open in Madison. The number at 263-1890, otherwise toll free at 800-642-1234. We'll talk about trees and other gardening topics as well. And we'll start off with Duane in Marshfield. And Duane, what's on your mind today? Duane, of course, you're going to have to turn the radio all the way off.
Hello.
There you are.
Hi, Duane.
Go ahead.
Yes, I would like more information about tomato leaf curl. In July, my tomato plants, the leaves curled upwards. And I went on the internet and got a lot of information about that. And it's could be due to a number of different causes, a drought, too wet, et cetera, and said it normally does not affect your production. However, my garden was not overly wet, but it was watered adequately, and my production of tomatoes have gone right downhill. And I just was wondering, what is the cause of it, and
okay.
what could I do to... do I need to be worried about in the future?
Good question, Dwayne. We saw a lot of this year, and part of it is it can be caused by drought, as you mentioned, dry soils, but also excessive heat. Even though you watered thoroughly, I'm sure, to encourage good deep roots, and that's one of the biggest problems I see during dry periods, and it's hard to talk drought when we're all looking at the gray skies out there. But with that drought, that extended dry period we had, what I often see is improper watering, shallow, frequent waterings. And what we want to do is thorough, deep watering. So you water thoroughly to encourage good, deep roots that are going to be more drought tolerant. Even if you watered that way, with the high temperatures we had, sometimes the plants lose water faster than they can absorb it. And that's why we saw scorch on a lot of plants, where we have brown leaf edges. Tomatoes curl their leaves as kind of a conservation method to help conserve moisture and reduce transpiration. So it's really a self-defense mechanism. And, you know, and then, so, and I'm with you. I'm probably run my plants a little drier than you do. I have good ripe tomatoes early, but my production's down a little bit. And a lot of that's because of the heat stress and the moisture. And so even though you're watering, we can't control the temperature. Aphids were another cause. When they feed, usually those roll down and over, so they curl outward, downward. And aphids are small teardrop-shaped insects, and I saw tons of them on a variety of plants this year. And they suck plant juices, secrete the excess as a clear, sticky substance. So, you know, if you ever park your car under a big maple tree and your windshield's sticky, often there are aphids feeding up there. And I saw a lot more sticky windshields this year than mm-hmm. I have. The rains have definitely washed a lot of the aphids away. You know, extensive feeding can cause yellowing leaf drop eventually and reduce production. I really think that there's nothing you could have done to improve your production. Really typically don't see diseases. Diseases that are involved usually have some yellowing, leaf spot, and leaf drop. And so if you didn't see any of that, it was probably more environmental. Nothing you can do. Just continue as the temperatures cool. Hopefully those flower blossoms that have formed late in the season, that we'll see an increase in fruit production.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
Dwayne,
good
thank
luck.
You very much for the call.
And I just want to mention, Jim, on my website, I do podcasting as well. And a couple weeks ago, I talked about tomato troubles. So if you check out my podcast page, I talk about a variety of things. And I know a lot of people are suffering a variety of tomato troubles. So
yes.
We don't cover it today. Check that out.
MelindaMyers.com, and you'll see in there her media schedule and places that she's going to be, and Wisconsin Public Radio is on the list.
That's,
so,
of course.
Keep up with what she's doing and where she's going to be talking, and also you have your Garden Moment video as well.
Right.
That's something new this year, isn't it?
It is. And so we're airing on stations at 11 different states across the country here in all of Wisconsin except the Green Bay area. We're still working on that. But then you can also check the ones that have already played, and you can do video streaming and see the tip. Anything from watering to slug control to container planting and care. So we try to cover some basics that can help gardeners no matter where you live and no matter what your level. A little tip that, oh, I never thought of it, is always my goal when I'm putting these together, as well as some basic information.
And that's all at MelindaMyers.com. Let's go to Annabelle next. And Annabelle is in Fort Atkinson. Hello, Annabelle.
Good morning. I have a question about what to do with my amaryllis bulbs or plants. Last year I talked to someone, I don't know, remember who it was, about the fact that my amaryllis bulbs did not blossom very well. I have probably a dozen bulbs of various sizes that I've had over the years. And it was suggested that I probably needed to repot. So I repotted all of them. And this year, none of them blossomed. I usually have taken them outside in the summer. I decided this year I would not, so I have them in my lower basement where they get right next to a window that gets sun from the west in the afternoon. and the leaves are long. They're probably 15, 16 inches high, maybe. My question is this. Should I just now stop watering them and put them in a different place and let them dry off as I would have done if I'd taken them outside?
Great question. And first of all, anybody trying to rebloom amaryllis and not having luck, congratulations, you're in the majority, okay? Those of you that have success, pat yourself on the back. It's pretty tricky to do. There are a couple different ways you can handle amaryllis. And a friend of mine told me about how a lot of the Europeans do it, and they don't have theirs go dormant. They grow them year-round. And what I've had very good success with, this is how I manage mine, and then I'll tell you some other options from gardeners who've also found other success, is I take mine outside for the summer, grow them all summer, bring them inside, put them in a sunny window, run them a little dry in the cool place like my laundry room where I remember to water them occasionally. So the leaves usually dry back, they go dormant, and then come January they shoot up new flowers. So it's not cold, they're in the sunlight, so any leaves that are on there are still working, and that's kind of what the Europeans do. They keep them somewhat growing year round. I've had luck with mine blooming every winter and then often again in the summer. So that's worked for me. Another gentleman from Waukesha wrote to me and showed me pictures, and he plants his right in the garden every summer, digs them up the end of the season, stores them bare root in a cool, dark place, repots them right after Christmas. They bloom, they flower, and they keep multiplying. And he's had great success. Now, I have to tell you honestly, I did that one year and forgot where I hid the bulb. So I can't do that. So that doesn't work for me. And then the more traditional way is what you're talking about, Annabelle, which is grow it all season. I would wait another month, maybe, especially since yours are inside. Then you slow down on the watering. Hopefully you stop fertilizing maybe a month ago. You let that plant dry out, go dormant, put it in a cool, not a cold, but a cool, dark place for several months, then bring it back into the sunlight, and then hopefully it'll start blooming. Or if it starts to send up a flower shoot, it's very difficult to rebloom amaryllis. It's a tough one. And if you do get leaves next year, what I'd suggest is use a flowering plant fertilizer, one high in phosphorus. That'll encourage blooming. And then I would, if you have a place you can put them outside for the summer. The reason I like to summer them outdoors is they get so much more sunlight, so it puts the energy back in the bulb. Indoors, even in a sunny window, it's hard to give them enough light to store the energy so that it blooms for you. So don't be discouraged, even if you don't get flowers next year. But I'd give it another month. I'd wait till the end of September since they're inside and then start gradually drying it off if you're going to store it dormant. Otherwise, you can keep it growing all year long and just cut back on the water a bit as we go into the winter season.
Do you think there's any hope that they would blossom if I kept them, just kept them growing?
Oh yeah,
there are big leaves and they look healthy.
Right, but one of the things when you see really long leaves, it usually means not enough light, so they're getting more leaves so they can absorb the light. So you'll start cutting back on that watering a bit. Okay, so not as often. So you're just keeping them going. But yeah, I mean, that's what the Europeans have done. I've done that somewhat. I just run mine a little drier, a little leaner in the winter in an east window and have had success reblooming them. I think the key is finding what works for you. And every garden you talk to has a little different technique that works.
Well, I have had success a few years back, but it's getting less.
And don't feel bad, Annabelle. A lot of other gardeners are shaking their head going, yeah, I know what you mean.
Thank you very much.
Annabelle,
thank you very much
for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our guest is Melinda Myers of Milwaukee. She is the host of the television show Great Lakes Gardener. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. Melinda Myers is our guest, and she'll be in Madison tomorrow for Wisconsin Arbor Fest at Warner Park at 3110 North Sherman Avenue in Madison. And you'll have the Tree Climbing Championship going on. And at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, you will be presenting Tree Death by Good Intentions.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the things, just all the things that we do thinking we're doing the right thing to keep our trees healthy. And, you know, and I do find a lot of problems often are good intentions. So we'll talk not only about putting beds underneath, but fertilization, mulching, watering, and general care. Mm-hmm. And the other reason I want to suggest you come out, if you've never seen professional arborists climb, it's very impressive. They do, this is a competition, but it's to compete to about all the skills they need to do their job well, you know. And the main thing I always hear is, wow, they don't have spikes on their boots. No, we don't do spikes. That's what the telephone guys wear because they're dead. Those trees are dead. It's a pole. But when you're climbing good trees, they use great technique for getting up, working in the tree quickly, but then also safely and for the health of the tree as well. So you'll see them actually, it's amazing. It's a great competition. The Wisconsin Arborist Association is very committed to promoting our profession and mm-hmm. making sure that trained, certified professionals are out there taking care of your trees. And this is a way for our climbers to show off their stuff and help educate the public on how it's done properly. So when you hire an arborist, you kind of know what to look for and what kind of things they should be doing.
So there would be no charge for either the event or parking
there. Exactly. It's a free event and it's fun for the family. Kids love to watch. You know, that's kind of one of the exciting things about my profession. Things with big equipment and ropes and climbing trees. That always gets kids excited. So if you're looking for something to do with the family, bring them out. It'll be a fun event.
So that's 10 o'clock tomorrow morning at Warner Park in Madison. Let's go to Dee in Kenosha next. Hello, Dee.
Hi. Oh, it's so great to talk to both of you.
Well, thanks. Good. Good to hear from you.
Well, you're talking about the perfect thing. I have, out in my front lawn, I have two white spire birches that I bought from Jung's. They've been in for several years. They're doing well. And we did put in a mulch zone around, which the grass constantly encroaches upon.
Yes.
And I don't want to go out there and put in the professional liner, and I don't like that look.
I don't either.
I'm thinking, now I've heard of people laying down newspaper as mm-hmm. mulch. I'm looking at a giant bag of shredded junk mail, and okay. I'm wondering if I could scalp the lawn in the area that I want to do, because I have some other plants around there. I'd like to make a larger bed in the middle of the lawn, lay down the junk mail, and then put the shredded bark we've been using on top of it. Would that, how can I do that? How thick can I go without, you know, damaging, you know, the air and water getting in?
Right. You bring up a really good point, Dee. One of the things that the weed barriers, the fabric weed barriers, should only be used, this is my opinion, but I'll tell you why, under stone mulch. Because if you use those fabric weed barriers under wood chips, as the wood chips break down, they create great compost. And then your weed seeds blow in or the grass grows in and you have weeds growing through the weed barrier. And one of the things I'm seeing is people coming in saying their plants are wilting and they're watering right, and I send them out with a shovel, and about 8 inches down, they find the weed barrier, because year after year they put new wood chips and they just have all this compost that's not fixing the soil. So it sounds like you're doing the right thing. Unfortunately, yes, weeds will come in either way. So one thing you can do when you start a new bed without chemicals is cutting the grass really short like you're suggesting. I've always used sheets, like three layers of newspaper, mainly because then you know you have a good solid covering, but you could do the same with shredded because that will mat down. Just want to do it on a still day, because I don't know about you, Dee, but every time I take newspaper out to mulch, the wind picks up. I'm trying to get the wood chips on and, you know, usually invite someone over to help me. So, you know, you could do like an inch layer of your shredded paper, and then I'd water it down to kind of get it to coalesce, and then put your wood chips. The good part about newspaper, it eventually breaks down, so it's not permanent, but it adds organic matter, but it really slows. It's that extra layer of mulch that really helps slow the grass from growing through and helps smother it and eventually kill it. What I do, I'm edging, you know, there are pros and cons, and you'll meet professional horticulturists that, oh, I love edging and this stuff will stay put. And there are people like me that are like, yeah, I just do a physical edge around my beds, just dig a little V shape and then fill it with wood chips so that my mower can go right around the bed. And that way I'm just, you know, keeping the grass out, but it looks a little more natural, which fits my style of gardening. And I'm not always careful around that plastic edging, so it's more real for me. So yeah, I think that would work fine. The other thing you can do with shredded paper, And I talked about this at State Fair, is making worm bins. And so it's a great way to get the whole family, a fisherman in the family, using red worms to break down your kitchen scraps. And then you end up with more worms at the end. And kids love it. I was at State Fair, so I'm hoping that next year the survey results will be better, because I only had 2 worm composters when we started. So we'll see if I had any influence. But it's a fun way. And the kids that came had a good time. So we'll see if any of them talk their parents into worm composting. But another way to recycle that shredded paper.
I have a brother-in-law who is an avid fisherman.
Okay, see?
That would be a good Christmas present for him.
You know what? Check out I sound like a terrible commercial, but on my website I have a 1-page flyer that you can print out on how to worm compost, how many worms, what kind of container, and you could have a lot of fun. I mean, you could make the bin from a recycle bin. I was at a trade show and they had this real fancy kitchen scrap holder that looked really nice, and I said to the guy, I'm from Wisconsin. I use an old ice cream bucket for mine. Or, you know, so you could have fun. That would be a great gift. Oh, that's, thank you, Dee, that you gave me another way to inspire
people. Who has everything.
That's right. Oh, good. I think we need to work on marketing together, Dee.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Dee, thank you very much. We appreciate your call today. On to Elaine in Phillips. And Elaine, what's on your mind?
Well, I'll tell you what. Thank you for taking my call. But a friend of mine gave me a hydrangea plant last year, and it's called a pink diamond. But there were no instructions except to plant it in the sun.
Right.
And we planted it last year. Of course, we do not stay. We're just here for the summer, and we go back to Pennsylvania in November. So how do I take care of this? It looks like it really hasn't grown much since last year.
You know, and the hydrangeas, especially a lot of the newer ones, have been really struggling a bit this summer. They really like moist soils and the heat and the drought. And I'm thinking in Phillips is probably pretty sandy soil up there.
Well, where we are, we're really in Lugerville, which is outside of Phillips.
Okay.
And we're sort of like on a glacier.
Okay.
We're back in the woods.
Okay.
And so, you know, we have rock underneath our so-called dry grass right now.
Oh, boy. So you've got everything. Okay. Very little soil and, yes. Okay. Well, and moisture is one of the issues, and that might be why yours was looking a little peaked. I have a Summer Beauty hydrangea that's been in the ground for 5 years. It looked really yellow early, and I already confessed I underwater, if anything, in my garden. And now that we've had rain, it's really starting to perk up, and it's an established shrub. So if it was struggling, you could imagine what your new plant's been doing with this crazy weather we've had. So one of the things I would suggest you do, if you haven't already, is mulch the soil. Evergreen needles are great. Just put an inch or so layer around that plant. That'll help conserve moisture, add organic matter. When do you leave? September, October? What time of year do you leave?
We generally leave the end of October. We're generally up here at the beginning of April.
Okay.
And then we leave to go back to Pennsylvania in either the end of October or the first week of November. But pine needles, I have plenty of pine trees,
so there's
no problem.
I figured you had that. The next step is where it's going to get a little tricky. One of the things we like to do with the pink diamond is a type of a hybrid. I'm pretty sure it's a hybrid, but tends to bloom on older growth. And so if there's any way of doing some winter mulching, and that's why I was asking when you were leaving, if things are shutting down before you leave, a few evergreen boughs put over the plant for added insulation would help. If you do it too early before it's gone dormant, you're going to stimulate some late season growth and rot and decay and have more problems than winter weather. If so we like to have the ground being crunchy and frozen before we start mulching. So if that's not possible, your best bet is insulation in the winter, maybe just putting a ring of hardware cloth or something, or a little bit of a screening around it, even if you don't cover the plant, like burlap wrapping around the outside. Just to cut the wind, just to give a little added insulation. If someone does check on your house, if they could throw a few evergreen boughs over top of it after the ground freezes, that'll help insulate the above ground growth. When you come back in April, remove that growth. Wait and see what grows. Just prune off the dead growth, lightly shape, and you'll get blooms off of the older wood. So just a little bit of tricky care on that one, but it's a beauty and it's a little bit hardier than some of the other macrophyllas. We've had pretty good luck with it blooming for us, but it does take a couple years to get established. So it sounds like you're doing everything right. Next spring, if you haven't fertilized, a low nitrogen slow release fertilizer, something like a Milorganite, something like that would work well to kind of help give it a little nudge without overstimulating stimulating growth and preventing bloom.
Ah, I see. Okay, because I didn't really know what fertilizer to use on it, and one of our friends swears by Miracle-Gro.
Well, and one of the things with Miracle-Gro, and you know, I am the spokesperson for Milornite, so I'll keep that in mind, but one of the things with Miracle-Gro is you do it frequently because it's quick release. So if you're doing that, you want to make sure that you're, I just tend to see people overdo it. So if you do it, you want to go light. If anything, you can always add more fertilizer and stop mid-summer because you can stimulate late season growth. So we don't want to keep fertilizing now. Otherwise, things will keep growing. We have a mild fall. We get a cold snap, and there's your goes your hydrangea. So if you're using something like that, a quick release, stop mid-season.
I haven't.
Okay. Sometimes benign neglect, if you keep it at the right level, works perfect.
And this other is Orgonite. I've never...
Milorganite? It's a Milwaukee sewage sludge, and its microorganisms are used to break it down into a nitrogen source, a natural source of nitrogen, an organic source of nitrogen. But it is a sewage sludge, so I always like to be upfront with people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just, it's a slow release, and that's one of the reasons I like it. So it's a low nitrogen. But there are other products out there as well that you can look for.
Where do I purchase this at?
Check at any of your garden centers. Mm-hmm. Most of them in the state carry it. And if they don't have that, they'll have some other low nitrogen or slow release. I'm hesitant to recommend a phosphorus or a blossom booster because our soils are so high in phosphorus in general that putting more in adds to problems with uptake of other nutrients. So before you really crank in the phosphorus fertilizer, you know, like a blossom booster or flowering plant fertilizer in ground, I always like to say get a soil test and see if you need it.
All right, Elaine, thanks very much for the call. Good luck to you. And we have a couple of emails to deal with, including a woman who has been having the same problem with getting the amaryllis to rebloom. Tried many of the solutions discussed today. If they don't rebloom after several years of being outside for the summer, should she give up on them?
Well, it's always on how much a persistent you are. I always joke that your last step in trying to get something to work in the garden is threatened death. And I always joked about it. Well, we get letters. I write for Birds and Bloom magazine, and a woman sent me a picture of a hydrangea, and she said she had this hydrangea that didn't bloom for 8 years, threatened death. And was going to dig it up, but then they decided to expand their bathroom, and it was one of these raised areas. So they put a lattice fence underneath it to keep the animals out, and sure enough, the next year, the hydrangea sent out a stem through the lattice and bloomed. And she said, for 5 years, it's been blooming for, so maybe threatening death. But yeah, if you're one of those avid, it's a personal choice. There is a chance. They like to be pot bound. Mm-hmm. So, you know, keeping it pot bound, it's really tricky. I'll be honest with you. I've had some that I've composted. And this last one has made it for, boy, I'm going on year 6, and it's bloomed every year for me. And I bought a new one last year, and it sat and it sat and it sat. And I thought, oh, it's never bloomed. And then, you know, all of a sudden it sent up flower stalks in about March. And I was amazed because I think I planted it in December. And, you know, I just didn't get around to composting it. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I would have never seen it bloom. So patience. But then, you know, at some point it's okay to say, I'm done with you. You're going to the compost pile. You're not killing your plants. Well, you're killing them, but you're recycling them into your garden. So I wouldn't necessarily give up if you have one more year.
And Kathy in Ladysmith has hens and chicks planted in moss in wire planters. How does she winter them living there in the northern part of the state?
It's a problem even in southern Wisconsin. Good question, Kathy. Hens and chicks are traditionally planted in old boots, in troughs, and things like that. And being in the south, we can maybe cheat the system a little bit easier than you can in Ladysmith. But one thing you can do is move that into an unheated garage. And one of the tips, actually, Larry had chimed in with this, and I thought, what a great idea is you put a board, if it's a concrete floor in your garage, for added insulation, okay? Set that in there, surround it with insulating materials, you know, the junk we all have in our mm-hmm, garage, mm-hmm. and then water it anytime the soil is dry and not frozen. But that's usually gives it in an unheated garage a dormant period, so you don't need the light, and you're not stimulating growth that you can't manage. But then it's also, you're keeping it protected from the extreme cold. For those of you that may have put them in a pot that could be buried, you could sink the pot into the garden for the winter. After the ground freezes, a few evergreen branches on top would be fine.
Okay.
But in her pot, it sounds like she doesn't want to bury that moss-filled pot. So just in the unheated garage, an unheated shed maybe if it's big enough, you know, that you could get an added insulation or a porch, or a basement's usually too warm, you'll get some growth. So try one of those things.
Mel Myers is our guest. Our telephone number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll free at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Dick in Lake Villa. Hi, Dick. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Before my garden went underwater, which it is now.
Oh, sorry to hear that. Yeah. Oh, that's got to be disheartening.
I grew tomatoes, and I had some tomatoes that were perfect. And I had others that had no seeds, and the inside of them, where it's usually light, pale yellow, was as hard as a rock. I've never had that before.
Yeah, a couple things that happen when we have extreme temperatures, and I was doing some research on this because the weather, you know, I always blame, you know, sometimes I feel like people go, Melinda, is there something other than the weather than you, that you can blame? But when we have extreme temperatures, the female part of the flower can be adversely affected, that fertilization doesn't happen properly, so we can get malformed fruit. When we don't see seeds, it means fertilization didn't occur or didn't happen properly. And you think about when a lot of us were having flowers on our tomatoes, we're suffering from some pretty extreme heat. So chemical response, herbicide damage, but then also extreme hot or extreme cold. And I think that's, you know, some may have been in an area that were a bit warmer or at a different stage of development when the really high temperatures hit. And that's why you're seeing it. Nothing that you did wrong. You know, this has been a real roller coaster of a summer this year. Who would have thought we'd be seeing August weather like this? So I'm sorry to hear that, and I'm sorry to hear your garden's underwater. So I would just enjoy the good harvest and the fruit that you could compost them. They're not diseased. It's more of a physiological disorder that's related to the weather conditions.
Dick?
It was some of them were on the same plant, though.
Right. And what I'm suggesting is they might have been at a different stage of development. So the flower, because what happens when the flowers are open and getting pollinated, and then the pollen has to go down the female part of the flower to get fertilized so that fruit forms. And so what may have happened is the flowers that are deformed or misformed, they were at a different stage of development than those that looked really good. So the heat would affect the ones that were at that sensitive stage or at that stage where fertilization was trying to happen, where the others may have already been fertilized, so the fruit developed normally. Or the flowers were younger and were fertilized during a cooler period, just a bit cooler period, where they weren't affected. And that's why you can see such a difference on the plants, because all the flowers don't mature at the same time, don't open and, you know, get pollinated and fertilized at the exact same time.
I understand that, because we had temperatures 90 one day, and it was down to 43 the next day.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and I know it's frustrating, and you're like, I want an answer, and what can I do to fix it? And unfortunately, it was nothing you did wrong. And you're right, it was a crazy year this year. And now it's like, if it's not 95, it's raining. So, and I'm sorry to hear your garden's underwater, but yeah, it was really nothing you did. And it's just that whole things in the garden, well, you know how things grow. So crazy overnight in the summer. And
right.
So flowers are coming and going and getting pollinated and fertilized. So that's why you can see such differences in your tomatoes on the same plant when it's related to environmental issues. But great question.
Dick, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. And on to Norman in Wausau. Go ahead, Norman.
Good morning.
Hi, Norman.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great. I got two questions. One is, with this rain and humidity, my garden is dying of fungi. My raspberries are got this gray mold on them, and, of course, the grapes are getting the mildew on them. That's my first question. What is the best way to handle that?
One of the problems, too, is in, is this your fall
raspberries.
Okay, fall raspberries. Some of your fungicides, some of the copper-containing fungicides are labeled for using on fruit crops, and they have a short period between spray and harvest. And that's the real critical thing with a fungicide. It won't cure what's affected, but it'll prevent infection on the fruit that's still forming and ripening. But always check the label, because there's that waiting period from the time you apply to you harvest. So the copper-based fungicide, most organic gardeners classify that as okay because it's basically listed as one of the EPA, I think it's no toxic chemical. There are some new plant oils like neem, N as in Nancy, EE, M as in Mary, that also have a very no low toxicity as it comes to EPA. But you always want to check, and I never go by my memory. It's not a good thing, Norm. So we want to just check the label. So if you go down if you want to do something other than pick off what's affected and keep cleaning up and hoping the weather changes and the plants deal with it, that's the only non-chemical way. And otherwise, looking for one of these more environmentally friendly that has a short waiting period. Because the problem is if you spray and you have to wait too long, by the time you can harvest, they're rotting because they're overripe. So I would check some of the copper-based fungicide, the sprays, some of the more natural products like the neem, and then check the label for those and see what the waiting period is from the last application to harvest.
Would the Captan work, or is that not acceptable?
Well, check the label, and I think it has a little bit longer waiting period.
3 days, it says.
At how many? 2 days?
Three. 3 days for cane fruits.
Right. So then, you know, so then that would be an option for you. Just read and follow. If it's labeled on there, if raspberries and grapes are labeled on there and fungal diseases, gray mold, it sounds like you've got a little bit of powdery mildew maybe, and then you would be fine using it.
The other question I have is I've had trouble repeatedly, and this year again, on the new growth on my blueberries, the tips of the leaves and also the tips of the growing shoots often die back a little bit, like a third or a half. What's the cause of that usually?
Blueberries typically don't get a lot of borer problems. You're in Wausau, so your pH should be pretty good. Your drainage should be good. They like moist soils. And one of the problems with blueberries for a lot of us, those of us with heavy soils tend to have soil that stays too wet. Those of you with sandier soils have soil that tends to dry out. And I'm wondering if, even though you're watering, if it was hard to get the right moisture. There are some fungal diseases that cause tip dieback. And really, the only thing is pruning out below the wilted tips. There are some fungal diseases that can cause it, but we'd really want to make sure that was the problem and it wasn't the heat and the drought of this year. And last year, if you remember, was pretty hot and dry too. Not as bad as this year, but it was pretty dry last year as well. And especially if it's a new planting, getting it established, I would mulch. Evergreen needles are great. Shredded leaves, anything to help conserve moisture, keep the roots moist and cool. Water thoroughly. You may need to water a couple of times a week to really keep those roots moist. And it may be a drought stress as it's getting established. Avoid high nitrogen fertilizers that can interfere with fruit production and cause excessive growth and injure those tender roots as well. So I would start by just pruning out the black tips. If it comes back next year, you might want to take it in, check your extension service and see if they'll take a look or submit a sample to the plant disease diagnostic clinic and they can take a look at it. I think the fee may be $15 or
$20. I think so.
And if you have access to the internet, you can also check there. It tells you how to submit. It tells you the price. It tells you how to take a sample so that it'll make it through the mail and get to them so they can do a proper diagnosis as well.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Right. Good luck with those.
Thank you, Norman. Glad to hear from you. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Talking with Melinda Myers of Milwaukee today on Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network.
Visiting a historic lighthouse in the Apostle Islands, chartering a boat on Lake Michigan, or enjoying the nightlife of the Fox Cities, Wisconsin Public Radio goes with listeners wherever they go. Your company's message can, too. To find your local underwriting representative, call 800-747-7444.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Catfish River Arts and Antiques in historic downtown Stoughton, featuring quality antique furnishings and works by regional artisans in a restored 1898 department store. Information at catfishriver.com. Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us today as we talk with Melinda Myers on Garden Talk. Melinda will be in Madison tomorrow at Wisconsin Arbor Fest. She will be presenting Tree Death by Good Intentions. That's tomorrow at 10 a.m. at Warner Park on North Sherman Avenue in Madison, a tongue-in-cheek way to look at tree care. She will discuss proper watering, mulching, creating a flower bed beneath the trees, and pest management, among other things. And you'll have a book signing as well.
You bet. So I'll have both books available, and the proceeds will go to the Wisconsin Arborist Association, which is a nonprofit group that does outreach and education as well as promotes the profession of arboriculture. And they're sponsoring the event. So I want to thank the Wisconsin Arborist Association for having me. And it's also going to be a great way to see professionals at work in the trees. It's a fun event to watch. I'm a certified arborist, but I always joke that I stay on the ground and do my tree work. So these are the guys and men and women who go up the tree and do pruning and cabling, bracing, all that hard work up in the trees to keep them looking good and healthy for all of us.
There are a couple of events next week that we should mention. Twilight Garden Tours. The Spooner Ag Research Station in Spooner from 5 o'clock until dusk next Tuesday evening. You can stroll through the garden, see the trials and the plantings, listen to UW Extension horticulture specialists and master gardeners. So that's Tuesday evening starting at 5 at the Spooner Agricultural Research Station on Highway 70 in Spooner. That will be on Tuesday, and then the following day, Wednesday, there will be a Twilight Garden Tour at the Marshfield Ag Research Station. Same information there. That begins at 5:30 p.m., and that's on Yellowstone Drive in Marshfield, Wisconsin. So a couple of events for you to see, plantings, trials, talk to people who are in the know, get your questions answered.
Well, and it's great because you can see what the university is up to, and they always have great recommendations and good information. And it's a good place to stay current and find out what's on the cutting edge.
Let's go to Bayfield County and to Bill next. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi, Bill.
I wonder if you had some advice on planting raspberry and blackberry bushes this time of year up north here.
And that's your permanent residence, so you live there?
Yes.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure because it's so many people I talk to in my neck of the woods are, you know, have weekend property. A couple things to keep in mind. If you've got a good, healthy source, one of the things with raspberries and blackberries is virus is one of the things that's very devastating and easy to avoid, a good, healthy plant. So if someone's sharing something with you, make sure it's disease-free. Otherwise, say thanks, but no thanks. If you're purchasing them, make sure they're good and healthy. A lot of fall is a great time for planting. In fact, if you know, summer's a good time for planting. Spring's a great time. You just had to work really hard this year if you planted earlier because of the heat and the dry weather. And now with the rains, the soil's nice and moist, but fall's a good time for planting. If I was digging and dividing, I would wait till spring if I was digging and dividing and then do that and transplant in the spring. But if you can get a hold of some good, healthy plants, this is a great time to plant. Wait till the soil is moist but not soggy wet. And we talked a little bit earlier about all this rain is such a problem because with heavier soils and even in sand, it's just messy to work, but it'll dry out quickly. But with heavier soils, you end up compacting the soil. So when the soil's moist, when you grab a handful and lightly tap and it falls apart, perfect time to plant. And then just making sure it gets plenty of water, properly watered till the ground freezes. And fall's great because the soil's nice and warm. The air temperature starts to cool. A lot of root development happens. And so that's a great way to get them in the ground and started for the next growing season. So really start with a good, healthy plant, disease-free, no signs of drought stress, like it's been just barely maintained through the heat and the drought of the summer, and proper care once you get it in the ground, and you should have no problem.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Bill, thank you very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And we go on to Roman in the Wausau area. Hello, Roman.
Good morning.
Hi, Roman.
I've got a very small garden, and I've got a couple maple trees that put their little roots into it,
okay.
I'm just kind of hobbying it. I've had so much problem with trying to grow tomatoes and different things because of the roots and all and the shade that I have to fight. But this year I decided to put in asparagus and rhubarb, two things that I dearly love. And the plants were coming quite good and looked like they were going to really develop. And my wife is a coffee drinker, and I... had heard where coffee grounds are good, so maybe I over-coffeed. I don't know.
Caffeine overload.
But at any rate, the asparagus, after getting to be about knee high, started leaning over and looking not too good. And I, of course, we've had this hot, dry summer, but we watered regularly every day with our hose. And but I'm just wondering if coffee is good for asparagus and rhubarb, and if not, what can I do now to put on that to change the soil composition to get it back on track? Can you help me with that question?
Sure. The good news is the coffee is a great soil amendment. Okay, it's the coffee grounds are wonderful. You can either sprinkle them along your plant. You can work them into the soil. Throw them in your compost bin. Dee, if you're listening, your brother, can compost them in the worm bin. So that's a great way to use that waste product back mm-hmm. in the garden. So you didn't do anything wrong. Okay, so take that guilt away. And then the second thing is, you brought up a good point about planting. When you're planting near or under trees, if it's under a tree, light can be limited, but also moisture. And it may not be your case, Roman, but I just want to throw that out for everybody. I always tell people, if they have a garden under a Norway maple, for example, go out after an hour of rain and see how dry the soil is. It takes really good, consistent, long period of rain to break through the canopy and moist in the soil. And then the first thing to get the moisture are going to be the tree roots, not your plants. So a couple things, Roman. When you water, water thoroughly. I know that the temptation is to water a little bit every day. And one of the things you want to do is water thoroughly. And maybe at the first planting, you water every day. Then you start every other day. Then every third day, every fourth day. Now, in your case, being in Wausau with a little better drained soils, you might need to thoroughly water twice a week. On our in-ground planting. So twice a week in those sandier soils. But that encourages deep roots. And asparagus is down there anyway, 6 to 8 inches. So you want to make sure you got it deeply rooted. So that's one thing to check as well. So make sure thorough and less frequently. With the rains we've been getting, hopefully that will help compensate. If light is an issue, both rhubarb and asparagus do best in full sun. You'll see asparagus growing in the shade and rhubarb, but they're more spindly, not as much production. So if they're getting full sun, when the rains do stop and you have to step in with water, water thoroughly and less frequently, and I think you'll see your plants turn around. If you're going to fertilize, do something next spring, like an aged manure, like the Milorganite, like another low nitrogen, slow release. Again, we don't want to push a lot of top growth this first year, so wait till spring, and before growth begins, that's when you can do a little fertilizing. So low nitrogen, slow release to help give it a nudge without overdoing it, and I think you'll see a big improvement. I love the old saying on perennials, and I think it goes with perennial vegetables. First year they sleep, second year they creep, third year they leap. And, you know, when you see a garden and you live with it every day, you don't realize that until you look at pictures. You go, wow, that's right. Look at the difference in 3 years. So pretty soon you'll have plenty of rhubarb and asparagus to enjoy.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, Roman, good luck to you.
Thanks very much for the call. As we talk today with Mill Myers, the host of the PBS television show, Great Lakes Gardener, and she also writes books, columns, blog. She's got everything going for. And that, of course, is found at melindamyers.com, M-Y-E-R-S. Terry in Abrams, let's get you into the conversation. Go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, good morning to you both.
Hi, Terry.
Hi there. I have some potted nursery stock, viburnums, Northern Burgundy viburnum, and also some American cranberry bush.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'd like to address the problem of what I presume is a viburnum borer, small white grubs that destroy the crown.
Yeah. Viburnums are one of my favorite shrubs. They're four-season interest. They're beautiful, and they seem. But there's the viburnum borer that seems to be attacking all but the arrowwood viburnum dentatum, all but the arrowwood viburnum, and it seems to be spotty around the Great Lakes. But Wisconsin seems to be hit pretty hard. One of the things you can do to reduce the problem is proper pruning with your American cranberry bush, and a lot of those, they form a lot of stems, are kind of suckering shrubs. So taking out the older stems as close to ground level as possible so you get nice, new, fresh growth will help reduce the problem. If you've got the problem, prune out any damaged stems, get rid of them. You can use an insecticide like a permethrin, and you do that when the mock oranges are blooming. And here's the deal. But the temperatures it takes to get the mock orange to bloom are the same temperature it takes for that borer to be at a stage that it's going to hatch before it goes into the plant. So you'll treat then, and you'll treat about a week and a half later and another week and a half later. And the idea is, in case you don't quite get it the first time. And you just need to spray the bottom from about the ground up to about a couple of feet above ground to try to cover those stems with like a permethrin or an insecticide label for viburnum borer. That's probably about the only thing you can do other than not planting them. And obviously you've got a lot of wonderful container stock. I love Korean spice viburnum, and that tends not to sucker. So, you know, when you get viburnum borer in there, it's pretty devastating. And I've been able to turn a few plantings around working with people, but boy, it looks pretty ugly for a while. So I always tell people, if you're willing to take a chance and you don't have other viburnum and you haven't had the problem, I would still plant it. If you've got viburnum borer in your landscape, you might want to look for something else or use the arrowwood viburnum. So proper pruning and maintenance, keeping the plants healthy, pruning out when it gets infected, and then you might want to do a preventative spray. And if you don't have any mock oranges in the area, it's usually around the early part of June, around June 10th or so.
Okay, thank you for your help.
All right, good
Carrie,
luck with that.
Thank you very much. Our telephone number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. As we talk with Mel Myers, we had Lynn from Mesa Mania, who has New Dawn climbing roses that have done well. Should he prune them now before he has to protect them for winter?
Good question. New Dawn is a rose that those folks even in Green Bay are having good luck leaving them stand for winter with no protection. One of the keys with climbing roses is they typically bloom on old wood. Those old ramblers our mothers and grandmothers had that bloomed out in the open with no protection, bloomed once, and then they were done for the season. A lot of our climbers bloom just on old wood, or they get better flowering. So the best thing to do, Lynn, is if you're going to do any protection is either leave it stand and wrap it with burlap and put some evergreen boughs or straw in there and put some soil around the base, or lay it down. Use the Minnesota tip method where you lay it down on the ground. Once the ground freezes, then cover it with soil. Once that freezes, it's covered with evergreen boughs. But you know, central part of the state, which is a little tricky because they get cold and warm, and cold worse than we do in the south, not as consistently cold as in the north, they've been able to keep New Dawn standing without winter protection. So you might want to take a chance, or else don't prune, though. After the winter, prune out dead stems, and that's it. And then after the first flush of blooms, do a little shaping.
Mel Myers, our guest, will continue with our conversation and take your calls right after a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today for this edition of Garden Talk. Melinda Myers at Milwaukee is our guest. And Mel, thank you again for coming in to spend time with us today.
Always fun. It's always great to talk.
We always look forward to seeing you. And again, you will be in Madison tomorrow for an event at Warner Park starting at 10 o'clock. That's out on North Sherman Avenue for Wisconsin Arbor Fest, the Tree Climbing Championship, which is normally held as a part of another gathering, is going to be tomorrow.
Right. We usually have it with our summer field day or field conference, and we decided by separating it out, we could really focus on the climbers, invite the public to be part of it, mm-hmm. because it's an exciting event. And the Wisconsin Arborist Association is really about promoting our profession and proper tree care. And so it's a great way that we can show off the skills of tree climbers, some of the best tree climbers in the state, invite the public to come in and join us. I'm there to answer questions, give you some tips on proper tree care, and I'll be selling books to help benefit the Wisconsin Arborist Association so they can do more outreach and educational programs.
And that'll be at 10 o'clock tomorrow at Warner Park on North Sherman Avenue in Madison. And her presentation is called Tree Death by Good Intentions, which is kind of a steal from Death by Chocolate,
right.
Isn't it?
Exactly.
I think that's where that idea may have come from.
You bet.
Which, again, is sort of the same thing. Let's go to Warren in Madison next. And, Warren, what's on your mind?
Hi, I've got some container gardens in my backyard. I'm here in Madison, and I have some oriental, like Japanese cucumbers growing on a trellis, and they're doing really well. And lately, in the past couple weeks, they've been plagued by the dreaded spotted cucumber beetle and the striped cucumber beetle. and I've just been physically picking them off, and I really don't want to use any dust. It's the only thing I could see, a Rotonon or something, 7 dust is a recommendation. And I was wondering whether there's any organic method to try to repel them or anything I can do in the off season to try to get the larval stage.
Yeah, good. All good questions. Unfortunately, there's really no easy solution. Hand picking is probably your best organic option. There are some products that are a little more environmentally friendly that are contact. You might, with beetle type things, the problem is they have that hard shell. So a lot of the organics work great on soft bodied insects. But you might, there's a hot pepper wax. There's one formulation for insect control and one for animal repelling, and you might try that. You may have some good success with that. There's some other neem I mentioned earlier, N as in Nancy, E, M as in Mary. Many organic gardeners or environmentally friendly gardeners classify that as a more of a natural product. We've kind of stay away from the term organic because there's some strict federal regulations, and everybody has a little different idea, so you kind of want to read the label and see. There's a lot of other oil products, plant oils out there on the market as well, that tend to kill what they contact, don't have the residual. So one of the problems is those beetles are right in the flowers where the honeybees are needed to pollinate. And like you, I hate to use the dust because you're killing the bees that we need, and our honeybee population's got enough problems. So hand picking's the safest, looking for one of those natural products like the hot pepper wax, like the neem. There's some Piola oil. And finding them is one of the things that's going to be a challenge. So if you get to your local garden center, and here in Madison, I'm guessing you probably would have some pretty decent luck finding some natural products. Check the label, make sure they're usable on food crops. Just because they're natural, the other thing I want to tell people is they're made to kill something, so you need to use them just as carefully as you would traditional chemicals. The idea is they're a little softer on the environment. So there are some products out there that might help reduce the impact of the insects and be a little kinder to the environment.
Okay, thank you. Could I ask another question quick?
What is that?
I've got some seedlings that I planted, some seed of purple coneflower, and they're in 4-inch pots, and they've grown up about 8-9 inches this summer. What's the best way to overwinter them so I can plant them out in the spring?
Now, they've been growing outside?
Yeah, outside in a kind of a protected area, kind of a little mini greenhouse, kind of shade greenhouse thing, and they're not flowering or anything like that, but I want to try to plant them next spring.
Okay, if you don't want to plant them this fall, because you could go ahead and plant them this fall, but if you want to wait till spring, what I do with all my plants that I buy that I don't have a space for, and unfortunately that's too many, is when I pull out my vegetables in the fall, that's my vacant spot, and it's in a somewhat, you know, it's sheltered from the winter winds, and I dig a trench and I set all the pots in there, bury it with soil. Once the ground freezes, if I have anything that's a little borderline or I've spent way more money than I should have, then I'll cover it with evergreen boughs or straw for added insulation. But the key is to insulate the roots. So find a vacant place in your garden that's somewhat protected. Just dig a hole and put the pot in, or a trench to put several in. Cover it with soil, just the pot. Once that freezes, if you're concerned you need a little added insulation, you can use evergreen boughs or straw. But purple coneflowers are pretty tough. And as long as you insulate those roots, you should be fine.
All right, thanks.
Thank you and good luck.
All right, Warren, thank you very much for the call. Karen in Waukesha, I believe, is planning on seeding a new lawn soon if it ever dries out in the town of Trenton near West Bend, not Waukesha. The existing soil is sandy. The grade needs to be added to. Is it okay to add, say, screen brown dirt to the area and establish the grade and then seed, or does any soil needed need to be worked into the existing soil?
Great questions, and I think a lot of people are going to be doing overseeding, repairing, or replacing lawns after the hot, dry weather. The rains are helping things recover, so if your lawn went dormant, the grass should be coming out of dormancy, but the weeds also have done well. So great questions, Karen. If you're going to amend the soil, the best bet is to work that any addition into the top 6 inches of your existing soil. What happens when we put 2 inches of good soil on top of our existing soil, there's a change. So in your case, the topsoil would hold the moisture, but then when it hits the gravelly, sandy soil, it's going to drain quickly. In areas with heavy clay, you put that great, nice, well-drained soil. The rain goes through that, hits the clay, and it's slow, and you end up with rot. So by mixing it in, you have an area that top 6 inches where the roots are going to grow is all the same, which is what you want. So yes, you want to add that soil, do your grade so your soil's consistent, and then start seeding. So you're going to need to wait for it to dry out to do your seed, to do your soil prep, and then get that all established, and then do your seeding. Good news is, though, fall's the best time to seed a lawn or overseed. The soil's warm, the air tends to get cooler, and so the seeds will germinate quickly and put down good root growth fast. And so anybody out there also overseeding, when these temperatures cool off and the soil dries out, it'll be a great time to repair any damage that happened to your lawn.
And Karen also asked, do you know of a retail product that has the pre-emergent sidurin, S-I-D-U-R-O-N, in it that is available for consumers' use and would be available now?
I don't know of anybody that has that, and that's the one that's the pre-emergent that has the limited time between so that you can use it when you seed a lawn and take care of weeds but not kill your grass. The other problem is you need to make sure what weed you're trying to prevent too, because a lot of things like crabgrass germinate in the spring. So even though the seed's in there, it interferes with germination. I know that I think it was Preen had the product. I didn't find a place in Wisconsin, but they do have a weed website, and you might want to check that and look for retail outlet. So I don't know of anybody in Wisconsin. I'd done a little asking, checking around, and Preen was the only homeowner version that had the pre-emergent that you could apply when you seeded a lawn. But typically, you need to think about what those weeds are, because if they're not germinating, it's not going to help to have it down in advance. Mm-hmm. And so the other benefit, and you bring up a good point, Karen, by planting now, you get your lawn started before a lot of those seeds do come about. So good questions. And I wish I had a local source. So if any garden center people out there are carrying it, give us a call if you have it, so we can pass it along.
Lynn in Evansville, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Hi, Lynn.
My call. Thank you.
Yes.
I have two questions about trees, please, and they are the main features of my yard. In the backyard, I've got an old soft maple, and as it turns out, my backyard is on a slope, which is causing flooding because it's looking towards my house. The old tree is on a small knoll, and what I'd like to do is to fill in around that, which pools water, about 6 to 8 inches of soil. Since maples have shallow roots, will I kill the tree by putting that much soil in that lowered spot around the tree and tearing my backyard?
I'm so glad you asked this question. Depending on the species of tree, as little as an inch of soil over the root system as a whole can kill a tree. Oaks are very sensitive. Maples are very sensitive, especially sugar maple. And so we always want to be careful. Now, if you're just building up soil in one small area, it might be okay. This is where getting a certified arborist to come in to evaluate the situation, because the picture I have in my head may be nothing like you're seeing outside your window. And you're right, if this is a main feature of your landscape, the last thing you want to do is kill it. And one of the things I always tell people is, you build this wall, you build a raised bed around your tree, it looks great, it looks fine for 3 or 4 years, then about year 5, the leaves start turning early in the fall, maybe a few smaller leaves. Year 6, the leaves come out late, a little small. By year 8, 9, or 10, the tree may be dead. And so we don't always make that connection between the raised bed we made and the death of the tree. And so that's one of the problems or challenges with tree care. So if you're really looking at you know, not just adding soil in just a small area, but covering a good portion of the roots, I would definitely get an arborist involved. A lot of your certified arborists do a lot of work in terms of maybe not building the retaining wall, but working with your landscaper so that tree health is preserved, minimal root damage, minimal backfilling so that you don't kill the tree. So if anything, err on the side of caution and see if there's any way to do that. Now, obviously, if flooding is an issue, you're going to have to do something. So it might be working with a landscaper that has a certified arborist on staff, or a certified arborist in conjunction with you doing the work or a landscaper doing the work.
Okay, thank you.
Right.
And my second question really quick is, I've got a clump of old white birches in the front, again, a showpiece. I've been told it should be mulched, or I should have a mulch covering. I'm wondering what is best for that type of tree. How deep shall I put the mulch? And should it be wide enough to be similar to the canopy, or should it be narrower than that?
Oh, great questions. This is excellent. Here's a couple things. One is, the wider the mulch ring, the better for the tree. So we're usually the limiting factor. How much can you stand? You know, if you can take the whole under that whole drip line, that'd be great for the tree. The key to success is any organic mulch works great. Shredded bark, wood chips, any of those things work great. A 2 to 3 inch layer is all you need, and not every year total. Okay, I think we're a society that, you know, oh, let's freshen it up. And so that 2 inches becomes 4 inches and 6 inches, and we have a foot of mulch. So a 2 to 3 inch total area, and then away from the trunk of the tree. Don't pile the mulch around the trunk of the tree over the crown of your shrubs. It can lead to disease problem, adventitious roots forming on the trunk that end up girdling the tree. So just back away from the trunk of the tree, out as wide as you can go. And if you have grass under there now, we talked earlier about cutting the grass short, putting down some newspaper, and putting the bark over top of it as well if you want to speed things along. Some people prefer to use a chemical like Roundup or Cleanup. Just read and follow label directions carefully. And I want to put in a plug because I mentioned hiring a professional. Mm-hmm. The Wisconsin Green Industry Federation has their logo, and they sponsor my website, but they have a connection to their website which lists landscape professionals that are members. And when you're looking for either a certified arborist or you're looking for a landscape professional, look for those that belong to their local organization. The Wisconsin Arborist Association has a list of certified arborists on their website. So Wisconsin Arborist, Google that. I can't remember their exact website, but that'll get you there. Mm-hmm. Visit my website, click on the tree with the person underneath it. That'll get you to the Wisconsin Green Industry Federation, who has a list of professional companies that belong to that organization. If you belong to your professional organization, it means you want to stay current, you want to do your best job. And that's always a good starting point when you're looking to hire a professional, whether it's to build a wall or prune your tree or install a landscape.
Thank you.
All right, Lynn, thank you very much. And melindamyers.com is the address for Mel's website. Let's go to Rick in Milwaukee. And Rick, what can we do for you?
I'd like to know whether Melinda thinks there may be some special problems with growing a mulberry tree in the Milwaukee area in terms of the typical clay soil. Is that satisfactory, or would there have to be soil amendments? And do mulberries have special problems?
Mulberries are pretty easy to grow. They thrive pretty well. There are a few parks that have mulberry trees. In fact, the one across the street from me has mulberries, so I have mulberries growing in my garden. So if you get the fruiting type, that's probably the only downside. So if you're not getting one of the weeping mulberries that tends to be sterile, just be sure you're ready for fruit. And if you want fruit, that's good. But then the birds kind of help you seed that around. So that's the only downside. But mulberries are beautiful trees. They'll tolerate our soil. One key with planting trees is they found in research that when we amend that planting hole, those roots never go out into the existing soil. And so a better thing to do is dig a wide, shallow planting hole that loosens that soil. Plant the tree at the same, you want it to the root flare, where the roots flare away from the trunk, are at or slightly above the soil line. So don't dig deeper. It should be the size of that root ball from the root flare down to the bottom of the root ball. And then wider you can make that, the better, but just shallow. You don't have to dig down huge. It's like a shallow dish, so it's deepest where you're planting it, mm-hmm. same depth from the root flare to the bottom, and then, you know, start narrowing it down or shallower as you go to the outer sides. That'll help set it up. Once you backfill, water it thoroughly to remove any air pockets, and mulch with shredded bark or wood chips, and you should be off to a good start. I have not heard of any problems. There are a lot of mulberries growing in the area that are doing just fine. Again, the fruit and the messiness is an issue. Extensive roots, they do have pretty aggressive root systems, uh-huh. So you want to keep them away from, you know, don't plant it right up against the foundation of your house.
Okay, thanks very much.
You
All
bet.
Right, Rick,
thanks
thank
for the call,
very
Rick.
Much. For the call, our number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Mel Myers is our guest, host of the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener. And on to Marilyn in Superior. Hello, Marilyn.
Hi.
Hi, Marilyn.
Thank you so much. I have a problem with tomatoes this year. My tomatoes look beautiful, and they start getting red. And all of a sudden, I'm, you know, miss it by a day, and something is eating them.
Okay.
It's kind of like a round hole that are is in the side of the tomato, mm-hmm. but it's only the ripe one.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like slugs will do that. And slugs, you think they're eating your hostas, isn't that bad enough? But when I see round holes drilled into the fruit of tomatoes, the first thing that comes to mind for me is slugs, especially if you don't see anything around. They feed at night. They feed at night. During the day, they look for a cool, dark, damp place to hide. Beer really does work. The fermenting yeast attracts them. And that's one way to find out if you have the problem. Put some shallow cans and fill them with beer around the plants. You know, sink the can in the ground, fill it with beer. Or one master gardener told me, empty a bottle halfway, any way you choose, and then lay that bottle on its side. And so the opening is even with the ground, and the slugs will crawl inside. The benefit in weather like this, you're not wasting beer, because if the can is open to the rain, it just keeps getting diluted. So you might want to try that and see if that's the problem. The good news is there's a great product called Sluggo, and it's iron phosphate, and it kills only the slugs or snails for people with snails in their area. And they eat it, but if they slime away and die. But if a toad eats them or a bird eats the poison slug, it won't hurt them. So it'd be something you could use in your garden. So Sluggo. But you might try the beer. It's a great way to, one, find out if that's the problem. And you're right, it's so irritating when, you know, you're waiting to let them ripen on the vine so they have the best flavor and something shares beforehand. So check that out and see if that's the problem. The beer is one way to reduce the population. Going out at night on a slug hunt, sometimes great revenge, hand-picking boards between your plants. In the morning, lift them up, the slugs attached to the bottom. Kill them any way you choose to.
Well, is that slug all, A-L-L?
Slugs.
No,
Sluggo. I'm sorry, Sluggo. S-L-U-G-G-O. Sluggo.
Oh, okay.
And the active ingredient is iron phosphate.
Oh, sure.
So there's some other brands that have that, but you want to read the active ingredient because
right.
slug baits can be some of the most toxic products out there, but this one isn't. So check the active ingredient. Don't just pick up anything that says slug bait.
And they could make a hole of about an inch and a half.
Mm-hmm. When they start eating and they love,
okay.
Yeah, I know. It's very disheartening.
Okay.
All right, Marilyn, good luck to you. Thank you very much for the call. We've not said anything about oak wilt, which has been showing up, especially in the southern two-thirds of the state. What are you hearing about oak wilt these days?
You know, great question. Oak wilt's been a big problem. Dutch elm disease has been really big, and verticillium wilt. Our trees are under some great stress. I was reading something from UW Extension about the 10 years of drought that we've had mm-hmm. prior. You know, so we've had some pretty dry summers, you know, even though we've gotten some rain. And that predisposes plants to a lot of disease issues. And oak wilt will hit, typically our red oaks are worst. White oak can often get oak wilt, but sometimes compartmentalize it and recover, or at least not recover, but at least hold the disease back and still continue.
Mm-hmm.
Oak wilt starts as a flagging, as you know, and then spreads, and you'll get almost like scorch symptoms. So there could be other problems that can be misdiagnosed. Two-line chestnut borer. Borers are a big issue when we have droughts and stressed trees. So keeping your trees good and healthy is one way to prevent borer problems. Getting, again, certified arborist out to do some proper pruning. With oak wilt, it's spread by a picnic beetle that feeds on these fungus mats right under the bark on infected trees. And so when we prune, we create an opening that attracts insects, including this picnic beetle. And if they are feeding on an infected tree, they'll bring that disease right to that healthy tree. And that's why we don't prune oaks from April 1st through the middle of July. I'm one of those people, if you can avoid the whole growing season, don't, you know. They found those beetles very active throughout the year, even in Minnesota, but the fungal pads are worse during that period where we recommend avoiding pruning. But in a home situation, don't prune if you don't have to during the growing season. This is when you want to get a certified arborist out to take a look, because the other thing I've often had people bring to me thinking it was oak wilt was anthracnose. And typically on the lower third of the canopy, splotchiness on the leaves that in the brown splotches go over the veins.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people will misidentify that also. Great on the UW Extension Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. You can click on publications and there's a great publication of oak wilt and there's a good picture of it. And so keeping our trees healthy, you know, we don't think about watering mature trees during drought. Hopefully you did that then. Mother Nature is kind of inundating us now.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things to keep in mind. You know, your birches that love moisture but are susceptible to bronze birch borer need to be a high priority. Oaks that are mature can take it dry, but when we get to extended drought, good watering, proper watering. So keep an eye on your trees. Right now is a good time in between the rainfall to evaluate what's happening. Where's the flooding occurring? Is there something you need to do to fix that? Where are the trees stressed so that next year, if we get into a drought situation, those are a high priority for watering for you.
And again, you will be in Madison tomorrow at Wisconsin Arbor Fest at 10 a.m. Warner Park at 3110 North Sherman Avenue in Madison. And the Tree Climbing Championship will be going on. And at 10 a.m. tomorrow, you'll be presenting Tree Death by Good Intentions.
Right. It's a day-long event. So if you can't join me, and I hope you do try to join me, come and see the arborist at work. The Wisconsin Arborist Association are bringing that event to the public so you can enjoy that special day with all of us.
And it's a free event. And parking at Warner Park is also free. So it should be a lot of fun. And the sunshine should be out.
We're counting on that.
Thanks a lot for being with us, Mill. Look forward to another appearance with you.
Same here. Thanks.
And if you'd like a CD of the program, it's available at the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. I'm sorry we couldn't get to more of the calls today. Thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.